From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
She wore blue. Bluer than velvet was the night. Softer than satin was the light from the stars.
David Lynch is the creative mind responsible for Eraserhead, Blue Velvet, Mulholland Drive, and the cult TV classic Twin Peaks. His most recent film, Inland Empire, was premiered at the 2006 Venice Film Festival, where he was honored with a Golden Lion Award for Lifetime Achievement. His latest project, however, is a book. Catching the Big Fish explores his 30-plus year practice of transcendental meditation and the impact it's had on his creative processes. It is published by Penguin Group, and I'm very pleased it has brought David Lynch back to my show today.
How you doing? Good to be here.
How were you introduced to transcendental meditation?
Well, I got a phone call from my sister. I'd been looking into different forms of meditation, having before that had zero interest in meditation.
And what had suddenly piqued your interest in it?
What piqued it was a phrase, true happiness is not out there, true happiness lies within. And I felt a truth to that phrase. But as they say in the book, they don't tell you where the within is nor how to get there. So the penny dropped one day when I thought maybe meditation is that way to go within. But I looked into various forms and was considering this or that or this and reading, and my sister called. She said she had started transcendental meditation. She told me about it. I liked what she said, and I heard a change in her voice. More happiness, more self-assurance, and that was what really got me, and I said, that's for me.
Well, most researchers agree that meditation can benefit people, but they don't necessarily prefer one form over the other. There's Tibetan Buddhist practice, for example. There are totally secular approaches as well. Do you argue that TM is better than the other kinds of meditation practices?
Here's what I feel. The word transcendental, to me, is key. The fact that you can transcend and experience the deepest level of life, the unbounded ocean of pure bliss consciousness. That's where I think all meditations end up, and they call that samadhi. For instance, in Buddhist meditation, that's the last step of 8 steps. But Maharishi says, no, no, no. Start with samadhi, even though it's the little samadhi. Unfold the big samadhi way more rapidly by experiencing each meditation that deepest level.
So this comes out of the Hindu
Vedic tradition of masters, of which Buddha was a part.
Did you immediately feel a change, or did it take time?
Immediately. Now, when you transcend, which is the most natural thing for a human being to do, you experience that deepest level, the unified field. You've experienced pure bliss consciousness, the absolute, they call it, totality. You experience that, and that experience enlivens it. It begins to grow. So you start growing in bliss, growing in intelligence, all the qualities of that field, creativity, energy, power. You start growing that. And then the side effect of the growing of this unity is negative things begin to recede. Honestly and truly, no wishing for it, hoping for it. It just starts happening naturally.
For everyone?
Everyone. Now, everybody's ball of string, I say, unravels in a different way. But for me, my own personal experience was I had this anger, and within 2 weeks, it lifted so much that my first wife noticed it. And she said, "Where has this anger gone?" And I didn't realize it had lifted. It was kind of amazing how, and I've thought about, you know, it fiddling with my creativity some way, you know, in a negative way. Becoming laid back or, you know, just like so peaceful, you know, you're not interested in doing stuff. On the contrary, way more energy and way more enjoying of the doing. You become more and more you without that bag of negativity to drag around.
My guest is David Lynch, whose latest work is a book, Catching the Big Fish, Meditation, Consciousness, and Creativity. It is published by Penguin in the Jeremy Tarcher imprint, and this is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is this the first book that you've written?
Yes, it is. There was a book called Images that I, you know, put out, but this is the first written thing. But I mostly talked to this book. This book came out of a 13 university tour, and it was a talked written book.
So you were. You were speaking and things were recorded, and then eventually you just cleaned up the grammar. So this has to have come from a very different kind of a creative process than when you're working out a film.
Right. This is a lot different. When I work on a film, I go by ideas, which I think everybody does when
they write a script in a film?
Absolutely. The idea... I always say you're going along, you have no idea, and then all of a sudden, bingo, there's an idea. Now, a lot of times you don't fall in love with that idea, but sometimes you get one and you fall deeply in love. And if it's a cinema idea, you fall in love twice because you see what cinema could do to this with this idea. And then you know what you're going to do. And you write that idea down. Now you're starting to form a script, which is a blueprint for the film. But all the time in the writing, all the time in the shooting, every element, you're thinking of that idea, which is driving the boat.
Although, as I understand it, Inland Empire started as a long monologue that you wrote for Laura Dern and then grew from there.
It doesn't really matter what starts it. If it's one thing, I always say that's why, you know, like these things are a lot like fish ideas, because they could be swimming in schools, the whole film could be there, but you're catching one little fish.
So I don't have to ask you what the title comes from. You've already explained that.
Right.
But you also said that you were very angry, and I know I've spoken to a number of people who've gotten into meditation, Tibetan or others, and they often talk about how angry they were. Do you think that's what attracts a lot of people, the fact that this might be a way to find calm and peace?
Yes. It's a dangerous thing to say calm. I think a lot of people misunderstand calm for, you know, they think that they're just going to drift off to a cave or lay under a tree and not do anything. At least in transcendental meditation, it's the transcending and then also the activity. The activity is where you integrate what you got. And the analogy is when you're dyeing a white cloth gold, you dip it into the gold dye. That's transcending. That's deep, deep, deep in there. Then you're hanging it in the line in the sunlight. That's activity. At the end of the day, activity, the sunlight has taken almost all that gold away. But there's a little bit there. Keep dipping it. Keep activity deep, 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 you know, transcending. And little by little, more and more and more gold. So you're holding that transcendental level in waking, sleeping, and dreaming. And this is a very normal first stage of enlightenment for a human being. It's there for us. It is us. In the Vedic terms, it's called Atma, the self, the field of the transcendental, the self of us all.
You meditate every day, twice a day, right?
Twice a day.
And yet your films are often filled with dark and terrifying images. Mm-hmm. So all of that peace and calm and the dipping of the cloth and coming up with gold. It doesn't brighten things up necessarily.
It brightens it up so much in me. And stories, as I say, you know, they're always going to have conflict, turmoil, highs and lows, very extreme life and death situations, what make a great story. But the artist doesn't have to suffer to show suffering. That's the secret to it. So you can really, really create way better when it's flowing without the restriction of these things that kill us, like anger, like depression, anxiety, things like this.
Now, other people have gone into psychotherapy when they've had these feelings. You've said that you think it might inhibit your creativity. Why would the understanding of self that therapy promises have a more destructive effect than meditation?
I think that was a story that grew out. It's not understanding self in psychiatry, I do not believe.
Well, that's the whole idea. You look at yourself
and
try to understand
why. You look at your past. It's not really you. The you-ness, the I-ness, is that consciousness. And so it's not like just analyzing what you've been through. It's in other words, you get underneath the problem the deepest when you transcend. Like Einstein said, you got to solve a problem, get underneath it. You can't go any more deep than that. So if you can get down in there, like Maharishi says, it's like water the root and enjoy the fruit. Get the stuff at the root and the whole thing comes up to perfection.
Actually, there are many different kinds of therapy, just like there are many different kinds of meditation, and some just focus on the present. But how does meditation get rid of negativity for you? Is that different from getting rid of an artist's edge?
But that's such a good question. A lot of people, myself included, I wouldn't want to do anything that would get rid of an edge, a commitment, a strong force that's in you burning to make something. And so that's the thing you don't want to you don't want to fiddle with. So
people have Vincent van Gogh and you have some other people.
Yeah.
Not every great artist was crazy, but some were, and they and their work their genius grows
and
out of
it. People say I want to hold on to all those twisted things so I can do my stuff. My answer is don't worry about it. Start diving within, transcending. You'll still have all that stuff. But it won't be, you know, you'll be more and more filled with an inner happiness and an inner understanding and separate from it. It won't be killing you. You'll have an actually deeper understanding of all those things and way more ideas, creative ways of showing it. So the thing can really flow. Plus, you'll just be infusing so much energy. And you'll just pop out of bed in the morning filled with more and more ideas and bigger ideas because you're expanding that ball of consciousness. The edge will definitely be there and more of an edge. If you're dedicated to something, the dedication will go. You don't lose yourself. You gain more and more of it.
Well, you mentioned your first wife. You've been married three times. This applies to being creative but not necessarily to sustaining a marriage?
Yeah, well, the deal is, there's one thing I said, I think, in the book. The events of your life may stay the same, but how you go through those events will change. And that's something to think about. Instead of getting killed by something, it doesn't kill you. You go through things, those lows, and the highs won't, you know, overwhelm you either. It's not like you go in the middle in a lukewarm, mealy mouth way. It's just there's so much more inner strength to go through those things. And another thing that grows is universal love, appreciation for the world and the people. But still, you know, relationships, like many things in the field of relativity, have a lifespan, and it's just the way it is.
My guest is David Lynch, who has, as I'm learned how to stick to his guns on his films and how to negotiate with tough studio heads because he meditates, and his book is called Catching the Big Fish, Meditation, Consciousness, and Creativity, published by Penguin, Jeremy Tarcher imprint. We will continue our conversation after this. Back with David Lynch. His latest project is not a film, but a book and a foundation that he's created. The book is called Catching the Big Fish, Meditation, Consciousness, and Creativity. It's from the Penguin Group. You started out as a painter. Were you already meditating when you were painting, or did that come with the films?
No. I started meditating in the middle of Eraserhead when I was, you know... I tell the story also in the book, but I've told it many times. I was on the front lawn in Alexandria, Virginia, of my girlfriend's house, and I met a friend, longtime friend now, Toby Keeler, met him there for the first time, and in talking to him, found out his father was a painter. And I had always thought, growing up in the Northwest, that it was something I loved to do, but when you got to be adult, you didn't do that. And so this conversation on this front lawn at about 9:30 at night changed my life completely. And I wanted from that moment on to be a painter. And it was like such a beautiful, beautiful thought. And so that's what happened.
But then you gave up painting. Why?
I didn't give up painting.
You're still painting?
I'm still painting. Yeah.
Do you use those abilities to also storyboard?
I don't storyboard so much. I will sometimes storyboard a sequence when, like a special effects thing. I don't do so many special effects, but when there's a lot of people involved with, you know, timing and certain things have got to happen, it's good to storyboard.
You say that Eraserhead is your most spiritual movie.
Mm-hmm.
You must have been, so I guess that was because you were changing, but also you must have been thrilled that it was chosen for preservation by the National Film Registry of the Library of Congress.
It was very cool. Yeah, I'm glad they saved Eraserhead. It was just beautiful.
Was it in danger of...
No, all films are in danger. You know, you never know what will happen. And that negative has got to be cared for in a certain way, or it does deteriorate. And like they know, you know, a lot of film restoration is going on now, but by the time they got to some of those negatives, they were in pretty bad shape.
Now, that film took you a long time to make.
I kept
even longer than Inland Empire.
Well, I kept running out of money on Eraserhead, and that's why it took so long.
But what happens when you try to sustain something? I've wondered about Inland Island Empire because you kept on shooting and then stopping, and Laura Dern had to find that character again, and meanwhile she's making other movies and doing other things.
It's a very risky, you know, dangerous, squirrely kind of feeling. And yet, you know, if in Eraserhead, Jack Nance, I say, stuck with me, and for sure Laura Dern did. And, you know, it's just the two of them have that kind of thing. They believed in it and were made sure they were there.
I'm sure it was also helped by the fact that you shot it inland, Empire anyway, you shot it digitally because you can maintain a certain consistency of look, can't you?
No, it's the same as film. You know, the look is, it can drift, you know, all over the place. But what I found with digital is the cuts the downtime between setups, you know, to, you know, it's the most freeing experience. Very long takes with digital really can get down into a scene, and actors, you know, started loving it.
Because it's almost like doing theater.
Yes. And you could go two or three takes over and over again without stopping, so the next one can go even deeper. You find this magic that you wouldn't be able to find if you had to keep stopping.
Do you hold the camera sometimes?
Lots of times. And that's another thing. Holding the camera, you know... Before you have an operator and you're back behind a, you know, a giant, you know, form, and if you had an urge to push the camera forward, you're so far away, you can't do this. Now you're holding the thing, and that urge, it just just a little drift, it can make a huge difference. It's so beautiful.
You often work with actors over and over again, Laura Dern, Kyle MacLachlan, Justin Theroux, Harry Dean Stanton. Is it important for you to have that comfort level?
No. I love those people, but I always say you got to get the right person for the role. Now, if it's between an unknown and someone you love working with, you take the person you probably that you love working with. But you never know what that role is going to require. So lots of new people come along, but sometimes the old, fall right in there.
But there's also a matter of trust because
it's
when you imagine a scene, you are imagining it as you, David Lynch, would act it. And then suddenly you give it to Laura Dern and she finds things in it that you probably never thought were there.
Well, that sometimes happens. Well, the thing is that I go by a rehearsal, and that rehearsal, then I'm thinking about that original idea, all the feelings in that, and I'm saying, well, we're far, far away from that. Then we talk and we rehearse again, the idea being to get everybody tuned into that idea. It doesn't mean that they shut off their talent. They just now direct that talent down the right avenue. And we find that in all departments. So we're all going down based on that idea.
You write about how every screening of a film is different because it's filtered through the audience.
Right.
So we don't just have the idea filtered through the actors. Then we have it again filtered through the audience.
It's amazing. It can be very subtle sometimes, sometimes not so subtle. The film varies depending on the viewers. And it's a kind of an interesting phenomenon, but it's true. The film is the same, but the viewers change, the experience changes.
Is that why you're so hesitant to explain the meanings behind certain parts of your films?
No. I feel like for myself to go into a film, I want to experience that and then come to my own conclusions. And the more I know, the more I say that putrefies that experience. And so it's for those reasons, not to putrefy the experience.
Well, sometimes writers have told me and filmmakers have told me that they've read reviews of their work and learned things that, from the reviewer that they didn't even realize about themselves. Sometimes they think, oh, boy, is that off. But other times, wow, mm-hmm. That's something I should have realized about myself.
I think there's something to that. If you're true to the idea, it's like being true to the fundamental notes of a music. If you're true to those fundamentals, the harmonics will also be true. And then a reviewer may pick up on these harmonics and tell you something that really was there, but you didn't know it, but you were true, and then therefore could be there.
And you've compared cinema to music.
It is a lot like it. It's different, but it has these things. I always say it moves forward like music. It has sequences, and it has a pace. And so in a lot of ways, it is like a flowing thing.
Well, since you like the long takes and you like the whole idea of things filtering through the actors and the audience, have you been tempted to do theater? Because that all happens in theater.
You know, I've only done one theater piece. I kind of like the idea of theater, but I haven't had the opportunity.
My guest is David Lynch. He's written a book called Catching the Big Fish, Meditation, Consciousness, and Creativity. It's published by the Penguin Group. Transcendental meditation is so closely linked with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, its founder. Do you worry about the future of TM without the Maharishi? After all, he's going to turn 90 this year.
Well, I mean, Maharishi is the teacher that brought this out. It's an ancient teaching. He's restored it and brought it out now. And he's taught people to teach. So the teaching, if it remains pure, will be just as if Maharishi taught it.
There's been periodic negative press about the Maharishi and TM over the years, over his promises of feats of flying and invisibility, that he hit on Mia Farrow, that he tried to cash in on his connections with the Beatles, and that now he's trying to expand his influence through the creation of a political party and by offering TM instruction to many school systems. How do you answer those accusations?
Well, you know, when something is different, and this is, you know, because we're not taught about meditation and, you know, that Vedic science in the West, when something's different, so different, it's there's a bad reaction to it sometimes. It shakes things up and people react badly based on misunderstandings.
So you say that the bad press is simply that people are – that none of those things happen?
No. I'm saying none of those things – it's – I don't know what happened with Mia Farrow, but are you,
No, well, somebody, we're getting email from people and they're handing
okay.
it to me. Questions
now,
that I'm not going to ask
you. The thing is that Paul McCartney and Ringo apparently still meditate. John Lennon was said to say, I don't know why I'm upset. After a couple of years, he said, I don't know why I'm so upset with Maharishi. You know, I don't have any reason to be anymore.
Although he did write a nasty song.
Yeah, but there's... We have so many things inside of us, and meditation starts cleaning the machine. Many strange things, you know, can, you know, start coming out. The idea is to get that machine cleaned and infuse that beautiful being, pure consciousness. And let me just, you know, continue. Maharishi is bringing a technique that brings the full potential of the human being, brings out the full potential of a human being and techniques to bring peace. This is so beautiful and precious. And people say, well, I don't know about this. I don't know about this. But more and more and more people are turning to it because 600 or 700 scientific research studies showing the validity of this practice and these techniques, more and more and more brain research showing what transcendental meditation and other forms of meditation do, it's really starting to happen that people are paying attention.
Well, some people claim that having to pay to receive a personalized mantra makes TM more like a cult than other meditation practices.
Well, when you pay for a car, you know, you don't have a problem. When you pay for a technique, now the teachers, like my friend said, wouldn't it be beautiful if teachers of meditation could survive on their teaching? And there's a worldwide movement bringing so many different programs to so many people. That takes money.
You're trying to raise $7 billion?
I would like to raise $7 billion from my foundation to set up these giant peace-creating groups and to give transcendental meditation to students in schools, consciousness-based education, where the knower knows the self. You start enlivening that from the deepest level, and schoolwork becomes so much fun. They get along way better with the kids. You see these kids' faces, you stop worrying about them.
Well, I guess some of the suspicions has to do with the political aspect of TM. There's the Natural Law Party. You've been lecturing with John Hagelin, who has been the candidate for that party in three elections now, or this will be the third?
Now he's not running anymore. I don't know. It's to me, meditation has nothing for me personally to do with politics. It has to do with life getting better and better every day. There's not some kind of thing behind this. You learn the technique and you go about your business. And the reason I'm talking about it these days is because I've heard stories about the hell holes that schools are, stress hitting kids at a younger level, nothing resembling peace in the world, and seeing the results of, you know, kids who've taken part in consciousness-based education and seeing those kids and saying, wait a minute, there's no problems here.
What school systems are employing it?
Well, pardon?
Are there school systems that are already doing this?
Yes. There's a huge success story in South Africa where they started with zero And now it's been going for several years. A lot of heavyweight people are supporting that in South Africa. There's this great school in Detroit where they've had it for, like, I think 10 years. And there's schools in Washington, D.C. where they've had it. And schools that, you know, have taken this on have gone from violent, you know, places with a lot of heavy problems to a beautiful situation. And all these things, you know, people hear these things. They say, well, I don't know about this. I don't know about this. But if they could talk to this man, Doc Rutherford, who's done it in three schools in D.C., and talk with the students, they'd see that it's the real thing.
Well, people will be able to see you tonight at 7 o'clock when you'll be giving a talk and signing books with musical guest Au Revoir Simone. That's hosted by Catherine Lamfer at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store. And then you'll be appearing with Donovan Leitch tomorrow night. Donovan at 8 o'clock at Alice Tully Hall for a combination discussion about TM and a performance by Donovan, which is free. But as I understand it, people need to make a reservation at david-donovan.org. Meanwhile, there's this book, Catching the Big Fish, Meditation, Consciousness, and Creativity from Penguin. Is there another movie in the works?
I got a finished distribution of Inland Empire and then start catching some big fish.
Thank you so much for being with us
today. Thank you very much. It was nice talking to you.
On tomorrow's show, a look at how a team of 12 African-American salesmen at Pepsi in the 40s and 50s helped break the color barrier in the corporate world. And then a new documentary follows a Japanese couple's 30-year search for their abducted daughter. Plus, another documentary explores the life of the reclusive artist Agnes Martin. And on this week's Please Explain, we talk about cocaine. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Nishik. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Fran Jacobs, Lorianne Kruszewski, and Tess Hartman. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.